Just a few moments ago, we had the opportunity to partake of the Lord's Supper, and in doing so, we commemorated the death of Jesus. And as Gene was reading the passages leading up to his death and his death itself, it was very striking as to the courage and the faith and the dedication that Jesus had in going through with all of that. Because indeed, he could have called down 10,000 angels and it would have been over. But thank God he did not do that. When we think about Jesus on the cross, and the supper is something that we do every first day of the week, we focus upon the crucifixion, upon the pain and the suffering that he had to endure. And Jesus told his disciples that this was going to happen. This was not just a perchance event. This was not like, well, this didn't work out kind of a thing. There were a number of times that Jesus told his disciples that he knew exactly what was coming. In Matthew chapter 16, interestingly enough, after the confession that Peter made, Jesus had asked them, what do men say about me? Who do men say that I am? They give a lot of different answers. Peter's the one who spoke up and said that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. But it is right after that, in verse 15, in verse 21, that Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, to be killed and then raised on the third day. So this was something that Jesus had been telling them, that, well, this has got to happen. I got to go to Jerusalem, and the chief priests and scribes and the elders, they're going to kill me, but I'm going to raise the third day. Peter didn't really like that too much. And so in verse 22, Peter takes Jesus aside and begins to rebuke him. Can you imagine Peter? Well, yeah, I guess you can if you know Peter. Rebuking Jesus and saying, well, that ain't going to happen. We're not going to let that come about. You're not going to die. They're not going to, I'm sure, you know, whatever he told him. And far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. And so Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan, you're an offense to me, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. So Jesus, number one, tells us this is coming, but number two, this is God's will. Which tells us that Jesus knew when he came to earth why he was coming. Mark the 8th chapter, and in verse 31, Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days be raised. He was going to suffer many things. Again, going back to, as Gene pointed out in the Lord's Supper, is that this was something that Jesus readily accepted, and he was knowing that he was going to suffer. And I would also venture to say the crucifixion was not unknown to Jesus. If you lived in the days of the Roman Empire, you saw people crucified. Now, we don't see that. I mean, if you go up to, North Florida, you might drive by the prison, but you don't see, execution. In the Roman world, there were common executions, and sometimes they would line, I think about this sometimes, it's kind of grotesque, but it's like telephone poles going down the road. You just have a cross here, a cross here, a cross here, and there's bodies on that thing that had been there either freshly or... I mean, so crucifixion was very common, and Jesus was very aware of what crucifixion was going to be like, and he knew that that was what he was going to suffer, and that it was going to be a very terrible kind of a thing. And it was just a very overwhelming kind of a feeling to know that that's how I'm going to die, and that that's going to come about. In Luke, the 9th chapter, verse 21, Jesus strictly warns and commands that they tell no one, and he says that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, be killed and be raised again on the third day. And then he goes into the discussion about, guess what, you need to take up a cross and follow me. I think that's kind of a contrast. I'm going to die that way, but that's what you need to do. But then down in verse 43, he goes on to say that they were all amazed at the majesty of God, but while everyone marveled at these things, which Jesus did, he said to his disciples, let these words sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. But they did not understand this saying. And it was hidden from them so that they did not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about the saying. So the thing that I've often wondered is that Jesus says, listen, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer all these things and be killed. And they're thinking, now wait a minute, you said what? You're going to do what? And part of it was that they were, you know, not really connecting, although Peter was the one who said it wasn't going to happen. But they were almost afraid to ask him. You know, sometimes when people say something, you're kind of like you're embarrassed. You're like, well, I don't really understand that, but I am not about to ask the question. I do that too much. So the whole thing about Jesus' suffering was something that was very clear that Jesus knew way ahead of time, that's what's going to happen to me. And the way that he described it was, my hour. I think that's an interesting term to use. I don't know how you and I describe our death or our dying. Jesus called it my hour. And in the 13th chapter of John, when we come to this Thursday night, and I would frame this into the day that you need to understand, Jesus dies on Friday. He raises from the dead on the first day of the week, which is why we're gathered today. But John 13, just write it in your Bible, that's Thursday evening. We know exactly when that was. And so he's been preparing. He knows that this is the day. He knows that what's about to happen is about to happen. And he's known this for it, you know, in his ministry. He has told them this on a number of occasions. But he knows that his hour has come. That's what it says in verse 1. He knows this is it. That this is the time we've been talking about. You know, sometimes we talk about a lot of things, but they're in the future. And then all of a sudden, it's like, wow, it's here today. It's right. There it is. And think about Jesus, knowing that he was going to die and knowing that he was going to suffer in these ways. And now on Thursday evening, what he has done is he has gathered, as he has done for more than 30 years, to engage in the Feast of the Passover, one of the three most important feasts that they are engaged in. It's a very solemn feast. They do the whole remembrance of the deliverance from Egypt. They eat the bitter herbs and they sing the Hallel Psalms. And it's a very, very moving kind of experience. And so Jesus is there in the upper room with the 12. Including Judas, with the 12 and with the whoever else is kind of fixing things up, because there was a man who made the room available. So you've got this room with these 12, 13 men and others that are there, and they have gone through the Feast of the Passover, very kind of a moving thing. They're kind of laying around the tables. They don't sit up on tables like we do. They lay down. That's why they lived longer, because they had to get up and down so much. But they're just kind of, you know, what we would call kind of lounging out, although they were just laying there and they were doing the supper. And this was an extremely emotional moment in time during this whole Feast of the thing. It wasn't sort of a little quick thing. It had been going on for a few hours. And the whole time, as they're engaging in this whole experience, those 12 men, they do not notice what's going on in the mind of Jesus. They could have maybe paid attention and thought, what's wrong with Jesus? But he knows what's coming. Notice verse 1. Jesus knew his hour had come. Jesus knew, tomorrow I die. Tomorrow they take nails and they nail me to a cross. Tomorrow I am going to experience literally what I have seen with my eyes. He knew that it was that hour, and there was sort of a mixture here that he knew that the cross was waiting for him, but there was a sense of joy because he knew that he was going to depart this world to the Father. But he knew that the only way that was going to happen is he's going to have to die first. And so there was sort of a mixture there. And he knew that his death would send his disciples into a panic. And again, we think about that. It doesn't connect and it doesn't relate, but I remember when their children were young and we would take them to the doctor, we're thinking, they're getting 3 shots. They have no clue. We do. And we know they are not going to be happy. We've already bought the ice cream, got the popsicles all set, because we know when they get, we know. But imagine being Jesus and sitting there, and you know that tomorrow you're going to die. And everybody's sort of doing their thing, and they're oblivious to what's going on. But he knows that his death is going to break their hearts. And he knows that what's going to happen tomorrow is going to absolutely send them into just chaos. They're going to be scared. They're going to be fearful. And Jesus knows that that's what's going to happen. And he knows what's going to happen with Judas. Because supper having ended, Judas is thinking, okay, so how do I get this? So here was the plan. You remember that the scribes and the elders had this thing that they sort of put out this little bounty. They said, listen, if there's anybody out there that could get us Jesus, we'd appreciate that. Judas hadn't heard about that. He had already gone to them earlier and said, listen, I can deliver you Jesus, giving some 30 pieces of silver, which wasn't really very much. It was the price of a gored slave. But he said, listen, I'll give you 30 pieces of silver. And they said, okay, and let us know. And so he's trying to figure out when a good time is. And so the other person that's in that room, it's kind of awkward, is there's Judas, because he's sitting there thinking, okay, when do I make my move? Because, this is probably a good time. One of the interesting things about that is that when Jesus was going to set up the Feast of the Passover, nobody knew where it was at. But Jesus and the man who made the arrangements, and I think that was so that there would be no conflict and they would get through all of this. But Jesus knows that Judas is sitting there knowing that he has already delivered himself. Now, verse 2 doesn't suggest that Judas is out of control of his will. This is just saying that Judas has already made up his mind, okay, I've got to go ahead and make my move now. I've got to decide when is a good time that I can go and betray Jesus. Judas, I would say this much, and this is just me, wouldn't charge you plug nickel. Judas does not know, and I don't even think he believes, that they're going to kill Jesus. Has no idea. He just thinks that they're going to arrest him, and maybe he thinks that Jesus is going to do what he's done before. He's just going to poof away or whatever. But Judas doesn't even know what's coming up tomorrow. And then Jesus knew who he was. I think the language of John is so unique here, because he knows the hour's come. He knows that Judas is the guy who's going to betray him. And in verse 3 it says, Jesus, knowing that the Father has given all things into his hand, and that he had come from God and was going to God. You know what Jesus was there for? To accomplish the will of God, his Father. And it wasn't that Jesus didn't know he was the Son of God. That's not his point. But Jesus knew that this was the hour. This is when prophecy is fulfilled. This is when he really becomes the light of the world. This is when he really becomes the hope of the world. This is when he actually embodies the way, the truth, and the life. This is when he becomes really the good shepherd that he talked about that would lay down his life for the sheep. This is when he becomes literally this door that is going to be opened into the avenues of salvation. This is when he's going to become really the King of kings and Lord of Lords. This is the time that he's going to be able to go back to his Father and sit down at his right hand. Now, I don't know what it means to say that, well, Jesus had been away from the Father for 30-something years. I don't know how to wrap around an eternal being living in the human body, relegating itself to a clock. But anyway, Jesus has been separated from his Father in that sense for a while. But he understands who he is. And what is really kind of interesting about this and shows the magnitude of what is about to happen, Jesus knows that he's God. John began his gospel by saying that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was, he's talking about Jesus, obviously, and you know that, but he says that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. This is who's sitting there at the table with his 12 apostles. This is the man who is going to die the next day. This is the man that is going to sacrifice himself. And when it says in John 13 and verse 4 that he rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself, and after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. That's God doing that. Divinity, deity, divinely aware of everything. Jesus, what does he do? He assumes the role of a servant. That's what he does. Jesus becomes the servant. He begins washing the disciples' feet. Well, he knew what Peter was going to do. Down in verse 38, he tells him later that, well, you're going to betray me. And matter of fact, before the rooster crows three times, you're going to. But this is the guy in verse 6 that when Jesus, I don't know who Jesus started with. You kind of wonder about that. Who was it that he started with? I mean, Judas, here's we don't know exactly the seating arrangement, but Jesus is probably here in the middle, and he's probably got John here to his left because, you know, John was the one who was very close to him. And I don't know, Peter could have been on the right, I don't know, or whoever it was. Judas was in hand's breadth of him. Judas was at least one or two people out because Jesus will then say that whoever sups with me the bread. So they got to be in reach of one another. So I don't know who Jesus began with, but he got up and he got the water and he got his towel and he began with something. Maybe it was Matthew, because you know them tax collectors, they got some filthy, nasty feet. Could have been Simon, because, you know, zealots always have them skank feet. I mean, it's just, I don't know, but here's Jesus, and again, they're kind of laying back, and he begins washing their feet. And then he comes to Peter, and he had ugly feet. I mean, those are gnarly, ugly kind of feet, you know, because he lived out in the ocean. And Peter, you're washing my feet? And it's kind of hard to know in some ways in verse 6 exactly how Peter is saying this, because on the one hand, you could say, is Peter just being, you know, rude about the whole thing? Or is he saying, Lord, you ought not to be doing that. What do you mean washing my feet? And Jesus says to him in verse 7, what I'm doing you do not understand now, but you'll know after this. In other words, there he is, and he begins to wash Peter's feet, and Peter's like, you know, what are you doing? And he says, you don't get it now, but you will in a minute. You will tomorrow. You will later. And you're not going to wash my feet. No. You can't wash my feet. And Jesus, you know, here, I don't know whether he's drawing his feet up and saying, well, okay, you can stop that right now because you're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus said, let me tell you something. If I don't wash your feet, you're not a part of me. And then Peter, you know, he's like, that's why I relate so much to Peter. I mean, you just don't know when to keep your mouth shut. And that, you know, Peter just says, well, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. You know, I don't know why sometimes Jesus just didn't slap Peter. You know, he's washing his feet, and he said, well, then you just give me a whole bath. And Jesus says in verse 10, he who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but he is completely clean, and you're clean, but not all of you. Oh, doesn't that strike? And maybe Peter and Judas were sitting next to one another. I don't know. Because even in this challenge with Peter, he reminds him, you know, which they don't know what's going on, about what Judas is going to do. And what we find here is that during this time of the Passion, that Jesus seems to seize upon even the smallest opportunities to instruct his disciples, to prepare his disciples for what's about to happen that they do not even understand. He's trying to get them to see a picture of the kingdom. They're oblivious. They think he's just washing feet. Because Jesus knows what's about to happen. And he even says in verse 11, for he knew he who would betray him, therefore he said, you are not all clean. Guess what? Jesus washed the feet of Judas. I'll say this about Judas. When he left in a little bit to go prepare to betray his Lord, when Judas left here in a few minutes to go betray his Lord, he left with clean feet, washed by the hand of the Son of God. Well, we could talk about a sermon right there about, you know, compassion and love. And Jesus knew what he was going to do. And that's why he said to Peter, not all of you are clean. He wasn't meaning literally, but of course, what was going to happen. But regardless of that, what we've got is Jesus with his 12 apostles, and what he is doing is he is washing their feet because he knows what's going to happen on the next day. And that's what he tells them in verse 12. When he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down. So he's washed all 24. Is that right? He's washed all 24 feet, put everything down, and he sits down. Do you know what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. And if I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor he who is sent greater than he who sent him. And if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. And I realized that they probably still didn't understand what he was talking about. But what Jesus does is he takes on himself the duty of a slave. That's what a slave is supposed to do. When you come into the house, that's the slave's duty. That's not yours. That's not hers. That's the slave's duty. It's a very lowly thing. I don't know if it's anatomical or what it is, but there's something just sort of lowly about washing people's feet. I mean, when's the last time that you wanted somebody to wash my feet? I have a daughter. I shouldn't say this. I'm going to be in so much trouble. We're doing camp next week, and our theme is actually on this. So I'm sorry, kids, you're getting this all again. But, I kind of laughed and said, yeah, we're going to have a lot of feet washing. And Susan said, oh, no, you're not. You ain't touching my feet. You don't mess with that girl's feet. No, sir, because she's got a hand that's balled into fist and she will take you out. There's something just sort of humbling about washing feet. And here Jesus, the master, the teacher, the creator of the world, washing the feet of the creation. He made those feet. He formed that body. And there he is, bent down, washing those feet and wiping them dry. Well, in Luke the 9th chapter, this is the message that he's trying to get to them. If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. You know what that passage really means? That means Thursday and Friday. We usually center that passage upon take up my cross and follow me. Well, that's what happened to Jesus on Friday. No, he did something on Thursday. You know what he did on Thursday? He abased himself. He brought himself down. He served others first, because ultimately what the cross was going to be was the service of others. The mission to the cross was the message of the kingdom. That's what the kingdom was going to be about people who are willing to first wash feet and then go die on the cross. And that's what he's saying is the message here. In Matthew, the 20th chapter, the same thing that what we find in verse 27 is that the imagery there, that if you desire to be first among you, let him be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. That doesn't make any sense. The Creator has come to be a slave. The Creator has come to be a servant. The Creator has come to wash feet. And that's why Peter, maybe and probably a good observation, nobody else said it, he said, how can you, the teacher and the Lord, wash my feet? You're the miracle worker. Your feet have walked on water. You have raised people from the dead. I mean, how can you do that? How is it that you, whom I have avowed to be the Christ, the Son of the living God, how can you be washing my feet? I will not allow it. You will not wash my feet. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. You're Creator. Now, maybe it's Peter's effort of humility. I don't know. But it seems such a contrast of pictures. You could imagine one of the disciples to doing it. It would be hard to see Peter doing it. But Jesus, he was the teacher. And Jesus is simply trying to tell them, if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, so should you. Now, the washing of the disciples' feet is not the institution of some sacramental feet washing. There are places that they believe that there's nothing wrong with feet washing. If you want to have your feet washed, knock yourself out. But there's no biblical authority to say that, okay, that's a part of the early church. There's no really example of them doing that in any other way, and there's no record of it being observed. What this was an effort by Jesus to show that self-denial is the basis of discipleship. We haven't even got to the cross yet. Jesus is showing self-denial. And I don't think it was very hard for Jesus to do that. I don't think that it was something that he struggled with and thought, Father, I don't really want to go wash feet. That's just not my... I don't really want to do that. I don't think he ever did. I don't think he had a problem with that. Somewhere in the plan and somewhere in the discussions that he had with his father, I think that there was a discussion that, when you're all together, wash their feet or however, and Jesus thought this is a good opportunity for me to show the disciples what servitude and self-denial is, but it was a very impactful statement. Because it was not the foot washing, it was the humility of God washing feet. And you got to admit that there's some people that you would think, I would never have imagined them washing feet. Jesus was one of those. But Jesus ends this by saying in verse 17, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. It wasn't just that he wanted his disciples to have clean feet when he gets betrayed. He wanted to teach them a lesson about servitude, which is what we find in the New Testament time and time again about the elements of the New Testament church. Clearly the language of Philippians 2 in verse 1 when Paul says, therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded. Have the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Verse 3, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than oneself. Let each of you look not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. You see, we live in a world that's about me, 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 me. We live in a world that it's me and I have my rights and nobody's going to trample under me and I'm going to be who I'm going to be. Well, that's not the character of the discipleship. And what Jesus was doing in the washing of the disciples' feet was that he was doing exactly what Paul says, is that he was not doing it but for any reason, for to esteem others better than themselves. And that he was looking out for, he was trying to teach them humility and sacrifice and servitude. We are here to serve others. It is not about me. My discipleship is servitude. My discipleship is not about me and my desires and my commands. It's about what God wants. And what he's saying here is that we need to have this mind that we're looking at, not for me, it's not because I'm not important. Because I'm going to tell you, if that was the case, Jesus would have never come. Because he said, have this mind which was you, which was in Christ Jesus. Jesus was God. He did not consider it robbery that he was equal with God. And if Jesus had said to himself or to his Father, listen, I am not doing this because I am not about to become one of them human beings. I mean, those creatures that we made, they stink, they look funny, and I don't really want to become that human being thing, and so I am just not going to do that because that is not me. Listen, I am God, and I am your son, and I am not going to earth. Do you think Jesus did that? Absolutely not. Thank God he did. God became flesh, knowing that he was going to die a very cruel death. That was the ultimate of servitude. And that's the kind of relationship that we are to have with one another, because it's not about me. In Romans 15, Paul addresses this clearly in verse 1. We then who are strong ought to bear with the scruples of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, leading to edification. For even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. So it's not about me. Washing feet is not about me. It's about being a servant to others and washing their feet and guided by them. And I'm to do that for their good so that it will lead to edification. Because Christ didn't do that. I mean, Christ did not exalt himself and say, I'm not going to do that. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and in verse 23, all things, what Paul says, all things are lawful for me. But not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. I'm here to look out for the other's well-being, not mine, because it's not about me. That's what feet washing is all about. Because my discipleship is servitude. The lesson of the Christian is very clear. Because that's what I find in the example of Jesus. Because Jesus left us an example of the sacrificial love. Let me ask you a question that seems to be the elephant in the room. You ever thought about this? Who washed Jesus' feet? I don't know. I don't even know his feet were. I think one of the things that's interesting about the story, whether it was just as an example or whether it was necessary, but usually what would happen is that whenever you go into the feast, particularly the feast of the Passover, you would take a very good bath, but of course by the time you got there, your feet were dirty. You know, they just wore sandals. And so it's very customary that when you arrive at the place, wherever it is, the first thing you do is wash your feet. Now, I don't know if they had washed their feet and Jesus just washes their feet again, or whether it was not done. But who washed Jesus' feet? The sacrifice that Jesus made the next day was what the washing of the feet was really all about. Because he was preparing himself to be a servant. And he was preparing his 12 to be servants. Sadly, Judas didn't figure it out. And he went and killed himself. But I have to wonder often that when the 11, as they were doing their ministry of preaching and teaching the gospel, that they didn't, as they bent down maybe to wash their feet, they reflected upon that Thursday night in an upper room when Jesus washed their feet and they missed the point and thought, I wish we had that all over again to say thank you. Paul says in Galatians 5 and verse 13, for you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. We're here to serve one another. We're here in the humility of a servant. It goes on in chapter 6 saying that if a man is overtaken in a trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, considering yourself lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let a man examine his own work, that he will have rejoicing in him alone and not on one another, for each one shall bear his own load. We're here to serve one another. Jesus washed the feet and said, if you will learn from this, it will do you good. May we all be servants. Have the humility of a servant. Not to be filled with pride and arrogance, but to serve as Jesus did. And willing to wash feet, whatever the cost, so that we can truly take up our cross and follow him. And that's what Jesus asked in Mark 16. Jesus came to serve. He came to die for you. He came to offer his life. I mean, what more can he do for you than to change your heart to serve him? Jesus said that if you believe and you're baptized, you're saved. But if you're not, there is no hope. Jesus washed feet so that you could have your sins washed away. Why not come this morning as together we stand, as we sing?